Something I forgot to tell you in the beginning is I don't mind if you fall asleep, but if you start to snore, please leave, because then you'll make me upset that I can't be sleeping and snoring too. So we left off with cryptographic key management, and we've talked about it off and on in other parts. Keys need to be identified and documented. Well, we pretty much did that with the normal system that we originally validated, so that shouldn't be hard. Keys must be stored under the virtual module's control. I mean, that's the only way the virtual system knows that they exist. You could argue that keys that are encrypted could be stored outside the module. It's a software module, and every time we take a software module through, we always throw that caveat, well, it's up to the engineer who installs the software to handle key storage. Yeah, okay, the problem is with the virtual system and the way it works, and because it's a complete system, really, you can't really say that because outside the module, that means the virtual module doesn't know keys exist. So right away it's getting asked to decrypt something and it doesn't even know it has keys. So you have to kind of keep them inside the virtual module. Again, all this stuff pretty much carries over. This is the stuff that you've done it over and over. Nothing is new when it comes to the virtual side as far as keys and generations thereof. If it already exists in your security policy from the normal system and you brought it over, you just simply have to carry it over. There's only one thing we have to concern ourselves with, and that's going to be the entropy and how keys were being driven. So as I said, all this documented from the normal, so it's a simple carryover. I can't find anything that would say there's something else you have to concern yourself with keys, you know, other than you have to understand where your keys were stored. So the entropy for generating the keys come from the DRBG. And I'd like to say this is the easiest topic there is because DRBs are pretty common. We all know what they are. You have to have them. The problem is today, for some strange reason, CMVP is asking about entropy and how good it is. I've known for many, many years that entropy was the heart, but for some reason CMVP just found that out. And if you talk to anybody within NIST that works in a crypto group, they'll tell you their number one concern, and in fact, they presented it last year here, their number one concern was the DRBG and entropy. With that said, that pretty much says the DRBG isn't going to be straightforward. So we have this virtual system. It's basically the same thing I had. I just kind of squished it in. So I got this system. Knock, knock. Anyone home? I need some good entropy. The hypervisor says, no problem. Here you go. The system goes, where'd this come from? Magic. Trust me. Don't worry about it. Yeah, as much as I like to say that's good, that's not. It is magic in some senses, but we can't trust it. We have to know where the entropy is coming from. Normally, crypto makes a function call for entropy. Makes a simple function call out to the various hardwares and pulls its entropy. In a virtual side, it doesn't know what hardware is out there, so it can't make that function call. So it means what? It has no way of getting entropy? Well, that's not the case. It's got to get entropy. And in this case, most of the times, the entropy is going to come from the hypervisor. And I will caveat this with, even though I'm talking about entropy coming from hypervisor, if you created a software-generated entropy and you put it in your system, then it's a whole different discussion. I'm not a big proponent of software entropy, but I know it's out there and it exists.
Linux, you call it right? That's where you're
right. Well, in this case, the DRBG, in order to run, has to pull in entropy. So it's going to pull in entropy from where... Well, the operating system is going to store it somewhere, and it's going to acquire it. In this case, the operating system that's been embedded into the virtual thing with the crypto module, it doesn't have any way of doing that because it's got no way of pulling entropy. So it has to go through the hypervisor. So the hypervisor tends to have it. In a hardware system, you know, the operating system kernel has a number of sources for collecting it, you know, which is kind of what you were just saying. And that's all pretty much the norm and how systems work, whether it's, you know, whether it's pulling it out of the DevU random or it's actually going to the various hardware components on its own and pulling the entropy. You know, all that was done in a normal system. But in a virtual system, it works a little bit different. I need a bigger podium here. Of course, as I said, there's a software entropy source. Some products will go that direction so that they can sit back and they don't have to go outside of the virtual module. They don't have to go to the hypervisor. They can it's all self-contained. Again, I'm not a big proponent of software entropy. I know it's there. I know it can pass the tests. So if that's the direction that you're going, you know, that's fine as long as you're happy and it meets all the requirements. You can go that direction. You know, and I don't know of anything that would stop it, other than maybe this. Before we get into the FIPS validation, we talked about a lot of, we talked about entropy. We've talked about hypervisors, so let's take some time and talk about hypervisors. There are probably 50-plus hypervisors out there that I'm aware of, and I say aware of as in I've heard of the names, don't know anything about them, but I've heard of them. They go anywhere from freeware on up to whatever you want to pay for them. Hypervisors are said to be have been said numerous times. We seem to take them for granted that a hypervisor makes it, or a virtual is a hypervisor. Not totally true, because there are different types of hypervisors, but the kinds that I'm pretty much talking about, and here's where I think you mentioned, somebody there mentioned about type 1, type 2. This is basically what we got. Type 1 is really what I'm talking about, which is the ESXi, the Zen, the Hyper-V, the KVMs. The Type 2 hypervisor, it's out there. I'm not real familiar with how it works, but I know it exists. And, of course, just some general terms, the guest machine, the host machine, and then the one that I'd never heard before until I did this research, and I'm not even sure how to pronounce the word, paravirtualization tools. Kind of makes sense, but never really thought about it. When you install a hypervisor, there's tools being installed that's required to make the VM run. So I deal with basically four types of hypervisors, and when I say I deal with it, I'm aware of the four. The one I currently work the most with is the ESXi. The KVM will be the next one I start to deal with. Do nothing with the Hyper-V, only because nobody's ever asked me to. And the Zen, we've had one customer that I'm aware of that's asked us about a Zen, and they wanted to make it, but I think the cost going that direction didn't meet up with what the vendor or the customer was willing to pay for. So it's not something that's big on our horizon. Hypervisors are virtualized on the hardware level. And again, you know, the ESXi, the KVM, the Hyper-V, these are the three that are out there. And I will caveat, the ESXi is the most common one out there, both in use and in sales. And I don't know if it's because it's freeware or what, but I just know it seems to be out there. But that doesn't mean that I'm telling you that you have to use any one of these. Use whatever hypervisor you want. If it works for you, that's fine. The other type of hypervisor is called a container. The common one is the Docker, Linux, and basically this is, to me, when they first described this to me, the first thing that popped in my mind is cell phones. It sounded like a cell phone where you basically created these little sections in a phone and everything ran in that section. And that's kind of what we're doing here with a container. We've mapped out a section in the operating system and said, okay, that's where my virtual exists. So it's a little bit different, but it has the basic same concept. And again, you know, they're very small. They package better. They actually built it. They actually come up a lot quicker. And again, all these various things kind of really made me think more and more about cell phones and the way cell phones work by having sections set up for the various programs that it runs. So basically, we're going to deal with these four because these are the four that I believe are the more common ones out there. So basically, a hypervisor, pretty simple. We have system hardware feeding into the hypervisor. We got hardware entropy that's the other side, which you can barely read. It's basically software entropy that's going into the hypervisor. And all that feeds up into the product, the crypto module. Like I said, it's a very, very rudimentary block diagram. When you start doing searches to try to get some understanding of the various ones, it's kind of interesting because they're really not very elaborate. This one, basically, you can see you have an application with an OS, and then you have the hardware running it. And basically, we take the virtual side and just lay it on top of it. Actually, I didn't. This is how VMware identified their program. So VMware, basically, the way it works for entropy is a timing source that it pulls from. That's where it gets its entropy. It's of the four I'm going to talk about, it's the only one that uses timing. Then we had the KVM, the Zen, and of course Microsoft had to overdo everybody. Those three pretty much work in the dev random, dev u random world and pulling everything. So they're somewhat similar, yet they're different. And I have to emphasize that. They may seem somewhat similar, but they are different. For hypervisors, entropy collected by the way of the hypervisor is not cut and dry. It's not. The entropy processes is slightly different for each. Each one needs to be separately tested and documented. If you sit back and say, I'm going to put my program, my virtual product out there, and you can run these hypervisors or any hypervisor, each one of them has to be tested. Each one of them has to be documented. Because each one, because it's slightly different in how it pulls up its entropy, you have to look at that. The link down at the bottom was one that my colleague presented last year at this conference. You can see it, and NIST still recognizes it. It just talks about how to measure and test the entropy. So if you've never done anything with test tools, it's a good introduction to you. So the big thing to remember is if you're going to sit there and you're going to advertise your virtual system with numerous different hypervisors because you think it's going to help you sell it because you can, whoever buys it can use whatever hypervisor they want, well, it's not that easy. You're going to have to test it because your documentation is going to have to show the entropy testing results for each of these hypervisors. This gentleman, Rafael, and I'm not even sure how, serious hypervisor vulnerabilities are relatively rare, but they do exist. The fact that they do exist is all NIST needs to hear. They hear that, so right away, they become concerned with hypervisors. And I can't necessarily say I can word or would disagree with it. Hypervisors have basically two ways of being attacked. It's the network layer or the host running on the hypervisor. One of the ways, and I'm not even sure if I talk about it, one of the concerns they have with hypervisors is you could have multiple VMs, and it's possible for one VM to basically attack the hypervisor and pull all its entropy, weakening the system, so that the other VMs that need the entropy have none available to it. Because these various things occur, you have to concern yourself with it. nothing is easy. As you can see here, these are four CVEs that exist. They go anywhere from 2009 to 2012. Okay, yeah, that's 3 years old is the most newest one. But they were attacks that existed that can made people stop and say, okay, we have issues here. Remember, we've only been doing virtual stuff for 7 years. So 7 years is not very far. And like everything else, the more you start to use it, the more it becomes prevalent, the more the hackers go after it, and the more issues we start to find. So the fact that we know some already existed kind of tells us that we need to be concerned. 2015, this particular attack was identified as a means of doing a denial of service. So you can't sit back and say there are no known attacks. There are some. Whether you want to sit back and argue, well, that's not something I have to worry about. Well, you know, that may be the case, but just be aware, if one exists, multiple exists. The virtual machine layer is more secure than an OS due to its simplicity and strict control. Compromising the hypervisor could give attackers access to all virtuals. Hypervisor is a program running on a host if it's compromised. So basically, we're basically saying the virtual machine, the hypervisor become the two easiest ways to attack your cryptographic module. And if that exists, we have to concern ourselves with it. And then the bottom three here is NIST's attempt to try to document something about virtualization. As you can see, 800, 125, 125A, 125B, we go anywhere from 2011 to 2015. They have started talking about virtual and started putting into documentations. So there is technically some guidance out there. The first threat to any hypervisor is from a rogue VM. Now, and you may argue it, and every time I bring this up to anybody, they say, well, no, because just the way a VM is designed, you don't know anything about anything outside it, so there's no way you could do that. Yeah, in theory, that's correct. That's the way it was designed, but that doesn't necessarily hold true as a true statement. You can put something in that hypervisor that allows it to go out, or inside that VM that allows it to go to the hypervisor to map things out. There are ways to do it. So you have to concern yourselves. So when you sit back and say, okay, I put it in my system, it's inside that virtual module, and everything is good to go, your user just installed another virtual module and just installed a third virtual module. You don't know what's in them, and they may not even know what's in them because they may have forgot that they removed stuff from it but left the module present. You know, so because of it, it could exist. Another potential threat, of course, is the IP or MAC address and spoofing. These are documented things that are out there as far as weaknesses with hypervisors and virtual stuff. I didn't realize it was quite so bad. The misconfigure of malicious VMs, you know, all of this kind of to me says, okay, that means you got to have somebody on the inside, somebody that, you know, well, disgruntled employees are a dime a dozen nowadays. So the fact that they're there, they exist, you have to worry about them. And there's not a whole lot we can do about it. Yeah.
So in addition to disgruntled employees, the other major problem is if they install a vulnerable VM in another place, because then you don't need a disgruntled employee, you just need somebody to compromise the other. Yes.
Yeah. So basically, and this is one of the things that CMBP was concerned with, and NISC as a whole, is, you know, entropy. The virtual module and the way it works today is still kind of up in the air and questionable. And of course, hypervisors, big factor there. And when you sit back and look at a hypervisor and the way it works, the malicious VM, you know, everything is out there. And of course, the malicious VM could be doing nothing more than pulling so much on the hypervisor that the hypervisor can't generate the entropy it needs to give to the VM1, which contains your cryptographic module. And that could be just because it was configured wrong, not just purposely done. October 29th, not too far back, this bug was reported, which I thought was kind of interesting, which again basically said we got some issues out there. And when you think about it, you know, I can remember years ago when we only had hackers going after Windows, and now we have hackers going after Apple. They start to go after something as it starts to become the prevalent way of doing things. And as virtual starts to become the prevalent way of doing things, they will see what they can do to go after it. So we just need to be concerned with it and recognize that we already know where some vulnerability areas exist. Can we lock it down? Perhaps not, but we can find other ways to make it so we can live with it. One of the things I want to talk about before I get into this with hypervisors, I mentioned testing and how you have to do testing on each one. You mentioned a comment to me. If you go ahead and add that. So basically the same thing that they want with OSs. And for those that don't understand EALs, that's common criteria lingo. what's interesting is there are none out there. You can go to NIAP's website, you will not find any. You may hear one or two going through the process, but none exist. So does that mean you can't validate? Well, CMBP, you've already got at least one validation out there using an ESXi hypervisor. How did you let that one go through when it didn't have any kind of EAL? You must have accepted that. So my argument would be, and that's the argument that we're going with, either pull that validation completely out or recognize that for whatever reason you accepted that one, you need to accept this. Yeah, granted, once we get to the point where we have them out there and they're acceptable, then yeah, we'll probably have to go that way. Which ones?
Citrix and VMware.
But they don't have a CVP.
But there are no protection for cloud-based, which does not use EAL. EAL does protection for cloud-based.
Right, right.
Right. And this verbiage.
But there are EAL.
They probably asked for PPs, didn't they? That doesn't surprise me because CMBP is not really.
When you have CCP, you don't have an EAL associated. So you can associate both those four and
you
try.
You didn't have four.
Actually, I left the Hyper-V. Microsoft has it too.
Okay, I'll have to go check on that because I wasn't aware of any.
But against protection profiles, you're right, though.
Well, protection profiles are relatively new, I think. I'm not a CC expert by any stretch of the means. So let's move on to the next four sections, EMI self-test design and mitigations of attacks. For those that know FIPS 140, you pretty much know those would be kind of toward the end. EMI EMC, I hate this. I think it's the biggest joke out there, but it's a requirement, so we have to meet it. Okay? That means every server system that you want to put out there has to have an EMI FCC test done to it. Most general systems that you run software on, your general PCs, all have that somewhere on a sticker. But if you're adding any other type of server system as a host to run it on, you have to meet this. I don't know any way around it. You can whine all day long. You can do anything you want, but I don't know any way to get around it. It's a requirement, and they're going to make you do it. I will say it's supposedly not in the ISO requirements.
Isn't that just for hardware launchers only, and didn't we just decide that this is software?
But you got a host platform you're running it off of, even the host systems. When you do a software module, you still have to have a platform it's running off of, and they'll ask about that. Like I say, it doesn't usually become an issue because with host systems, and anybody here in the lab, if you want to speak up, now's a good time. Even when you do a software module, you have to have the host platform it's running off of, but because you class it as running on a general PC, every general PC has a sticker on it for this. Even though that particular system didn't go through it, its parent did somehow. So I'm not aware of any way of getting around it.
I would argue with you just what she did, because it sounds confusing, but it's true.
Well, I'll throw it out to anybody here that's in a lab.
No, it's how FIPS is written. It really does require it for level one.
That's, like I say, I don't like this. I don't care if it's level one or level four. I don't like it because there's nothing about it. It's public information, so I don't know what we're trying to accomplish with it. It was great way back when they first added it under Rainbow Series, maybe. But today, I think it's long-lived. Self-tests. You did the self-test when you did a regular system, so they're going to carry over for you. Not going to have to do a whole lot of work here, are you? Unless, of course, you didn't do self-tests. And I want to know how you got through the process. But again, the only thing you got to worry about is your power-up self-test. Yes? You're from a lab. Why didn't you speak up?
Going back to the... Sorry, I took a time because I had to reset something. For the virtual virtual product that has been evaluated as a software and requiring year two, was it at level two? Because I could not find any level two virtual appliance or virtual product being evaluated. No.
For the hypervisor?
The software running on top of... Were you talking about
hypervisor? He was just talking about hypervisors. As meeting the requirements, correct? That's all you were talking about?
The statement was made about there's no EAL-based certified hypervisors, and that's not
right.
What there are.
He's basically saying that the hypervisors have it.
But I thought you mentioned that to evaluate a virtual application running on top of hypervisor, the hypervisor has to be EAL-2 certified?
He was saying that, because that's what CMVP told him via his lab. Right. And the software, and it's not a requirement at level one. But are you guys doing level two with your product? You had to be different, didn't you? I hope your life is filled with gray hair. there's always somebody different. But again, as I was saying, the power-up self-test is the big thing you got to determine. You know, you may have done it slightly different when you embedded it inside its own hardware. Now you're bringing it over here. You have to determine when that power-up test occurs. When did that module become loaded? That's when your power-up test has to occur. Everything else, you know, is pretty much going to follow the same way it did before. So you don't have a whole lot of differences here with the self-tests. Software firmware load test required. Can I externally load components into the module? This one took me for a loop for quite a while before I realized, and for a software module, the load test is applicable if software can be loaded within the defined logical boundary of the module. And I'm going to say that again. If software can be loaded within the defined logical boundary of the module, if it cannot be done, the test is not required. So you have to determine whether or not it can be loaded. And that's really the big thing. FIPS 140-2IG specifically says the logical boundary includes all software that is associated, bound, modifies, or is an executable requisite of the validated software or firmware module. So a lot of people would probably argue that this is, you know, you can't do this, so they would say it's not applicable. Again, just be familiar with the fact that 140-2 says one thing, 140-2IG says some other information, and you just have to determine whether or not something can be loaded or not loaded. That will drive whether that requirement exists. And that may be the only thing that you didn't do originally with your system, but you may have to do today. Design assurance. I'd like to sit back and say this is the easiest thing to do, because normally it is, but we're dealing with virtual. Virtual, because of the nature of it's twice as complicated as a normal system, says your design assurance better be there. You better be able to show how it's been designed and show assurance, because you're talking about something that's inside its own world, in another system, that's totally in control of it, but outside of your control. I can see the CMVP coming back and asking a lot of questions on how did you design this and how did you assure things were are kept clean. As I said, it's a rather low-level concern. And most of the stuff I've ever done, it really never gets looked at or discussed, because we simply say the code is maintained here and you can't access it and all that. Because of the nature being virtual and the way things exist, you're going to have to probably stretch this area and make sure you understand developing, maintaining code, delivering of the module, configuration, operational guidance documents. All of these things you're going to have to look at a little bit differently than you did with a regular system, because of the nature of the virtual. And I would recommend it, any kind of attacks or issues that you've heard of, if you can bring them into your documents and say that you've looked at that and make sure, that'll probably give them a nice warm fuzzy and they'll ask you less questions. mitigation of other attacks. Again, this is normally something that we look at when we're talking power attacks, not something we would concern ourselves with virtual. The caveat to that is it's virtual, and because it's virtual, there's all kinds of attacks. If an attack exists, okay, we got to look at mitigations. I can actually see this section growing because of virtual more so than because of regular systems, because we know there's certain things. How did you guarantee that you can't go from one VM to another? What have you done to mitigate that kind of attack? I can see that kind of stuff being done, and not just at level 3 or 4, but all of them, because it's just virtual. It's the kind of thing you really need to think about, and really, even if you didn't put it into your SP document, your security policy document, your customers should probably should be given that information. So it is something that you should be documenting it. So to me, this is a broad topic that draws a lot more attention in the virtual world than it did in the regular world. As I said, most of the time this is not applicable, but in this particular case, we may want to think about addressing this, whether it's done in a separate document that you provide to your customers, and if you know, and you just list it as available, or what. It's something that I think needs to be seriously thought out. What? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't see any way for that to be detected, and the only thing I can come up with would be NIST coming out saying that your documentation in the security policy that talks about setting it up in an operational thing, you have to identify that the admin who controls the hypervisor can't do this and can't do that, and these have to be. But again, does that mean it didn't happen? No, it's just. And we do that all the time. Because it's something that's kind of outside the scope of the crypto module, we kind of just make cursory mentions of things like that. But when that becomes an issue, then it becomes an attack that exists. And again, it gets back to my mitigation. You know, perhaps NIST needs to think about that. You know, and people don't like that when you start adding more criteria. But this is virtual. It's 7 years old. And because it's new, things are changing. I can call the CMVP today and ask for information on something. I can call them back a week from now, and they'll give me a totally different answer. And it's the same person, because they learned something. We're trying to get them to give us guidance on something that they themselves are trying to grasp. They're turning to their cryptographic experts, and their first thing out of their mouths is, We don't trust virtual. We don't even understand how the entropy is done and how it's good and solid from one hypervisor to another, and you want us to give you guidance. You know, there's a lot of things here, and for the first time ever, I actually have to agree with the CMVP that there should not be guidance today. That doesn't mean they shouldn't be validating stuff, and I think they're open to that, obviously, since they've already done one. We just have to be prepared to, one, be honest, give them all the facts. Two, be honest with ourselves, with making sure we fully understand everything that's going on in our own system and we've documented it. You know, and as long as we're honest and we're willing to talk, CMVPs, all you got to do is call your lab and they'll set it up and you can have a three-way discussion in person or over the phone with a CMVP and go through all this stuff, which is where it leads to here. We actually did that with Cisco. We got with their lab. We met with the CMVP, and we talked. And I was absolutely awed because they came in with some serious questions and some serious knowledge base. It's not that they were against virtual. They recognized the fact that the people that they're there to support, government agencies, want it. Well, if they want it, they got to get it. So how do you get it with causing the least amount of security issues? And that's really what they're trying to do, is cause the least amount. Does that mean if you get it validated today, will it work on the next product a week later? Probably not. It may be totally different because the reviewers will come up with new information. As more and more start to pop up there in the world, the hackers will start hitting things, will start finding out about other weaknesses, and that will drive requirements in testing. Will it get to a point where they actually drop it completely? It's always a possibility for anything, but it's, you know, for today's